From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is a demand from the people here, for both sides, for Hamas and Fatah, to stop the fighting, for all security forces to stop the fighting, to return to the rule of law.
Over 40 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza in fierce internal fighting between Hamas and Fatah. We'll go to Gaza to speak with journalist Leila El Hadid and to Ramallah to speak with Palestinian Information Minister Mustafa Barghouti. But first, untap the scramble for Africa's oil.
The United States today is getting as much oil from Africa as it does from Saudi Arabia, and China is getting about 30% of its oil from Africa as well. And if we don't start paying attention to what's going on over there, we're going to find ourselves with some real problems in the long run, I think.
We'll speak with author John Gasvinian. His book is called Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. And we'll be joined by war resister Agustin Aguayo. He's returned to the United States after being released from confinement at a U.S. base in Germany for refusing to load his gun in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, at least 25 Palestinians died Wednesday in a day that saw fierce internal fighting between Hamas and Fatah. Most Gaza residents were forced to hide inside as gun battles raged in the streets. At one point, a group of journalists were caught inside a burning building. Israel also carried out airstrikes in Gaza. Fighting decreased in Gaza this morning after Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas threatened to declare a state of emergency. Tensions also rising between Hamas and Israel. Hamas fired crude rockets at the southern Israeli town of Sderot. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes in Gaza killed at least four Palestinians. Israel's claimed it will not get involved in the factional fighting between Hamas and Fatah, but many Middle East observers say the U.S. and Israel have both directly helped Fatah in recent months as part of an effort to topple the elected Hamas leadership. The U.S. is spending $86 million to help arm and train the Palestinian Presidential Guard, which is loyal to Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas. This has helped pay for shipments of rifles and bullets. In January, President Bush's Deputy National Security Advisor, Elliot Abrams, called for a, quote, hard coup in the occupied territories to overthrow Hamas. Last week, a Jordanian newspaper obtained a secret 16-page U.S. document that outlined an action plan for undermining and replacing the Palestinian National Unity Government. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has rejected a bill to cut off money for combat operations in Iraq after March 31, 2008. 19 Democratic senators joined Republicans in opposing the bill. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin drafted the bill.
Iraq's problems will not be solved by an open-ended, massive U.S. military engagement. And, Mr. President, I am convinced that our own national security will be weakened until we bring this war to a close.
The bill was rejected in a 67-29 vote. Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia introduced an alternative bill that would have threatened billions of dollars in U.S. aid to Iraq if Baghdad failed to implement certain political and security reforms.
Now, the purpose of this amendment is to require the administration to keep the Congress well informed. The situation in Iraq changes almost daily. Our losses continue. And in my judgment, it is the responsibility of every member of the Congress to keep well versed on this situation.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid criticized Warner's bill as not going far enough, in part because it contained a provision allowing the president to waive the restrictions.
But Mr. President, the situation in Iraq is grave and deteriorating. It requires actions, certainly not more reports, especially those without consequences. I will vote against the Warner Amendment, and I hope everyone votes against it. It is nothing.
The Warner bill also failed to win passage in the Senate. Meanwhile, in Iraq, at least 88 people died Wednesday in a series of attacks. In Baghdad, 32 people died in a car bombing that officials said might have involved chlorine gas. A mortar attack on the U.S.-controlled Green Zone killed at least two people and injured 10 more. one of the dead was said to be a driver for the staff of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The mortar attack raised new questions about whether the U.S. can keep the Green Zone secure. The British military has announced Prince Harry will not be sent to Iraq because the situation is too unsafe. General Sir Richard Dannett made the announcement Wednesday.
There are a number of specific threats of a varied nature, some reported and some not reported, specifically aimed at Prince Harry. And it's for that reason, and in the light of recent episodes, and you refer to one affecting a US serviceman, that I've decided that the risk to Prince Harry is too great. But I've also decided that the risk that he brings to his troop and to his squadron by his presence in the light of those specific threats to him is now too great.
Members of the British group Military Families Against the War criticized the decision. Rose Gentle, whose son was killed in Iraq, said, quote, "If it's too dangerous for Prince Harry, it's too dangerous for the rest of the boys. They should all come home." April was the deadliest month for British troops in Iraq since the 2003 invasion. In other Iraq news, thousands of U.S. and Iraqi troops have been conducting house-to-house searches in an attempt to find three missing U.S. soldiers. Iraqi residents complained about the actions of the U.S. troops.
They damaged the fence of the house and entered. They damaged the house and belongings, seizing our money, gold, passports, and identity cards. They threw the old man here and hit the young man, too. They blindfolded them and bound their hands.
A Norwegian company has announced it will soon become the first foreign oil firm to pump crude oil from Iraq in over three decades. The company, DNO, says it'll begin producing a small amount of oil from the northern Iraqi region of Kurdistan. For the past 35 years, Iraq's oil industry has been under state control. The Iraqi parliament is debating a bill that'll open up the country's vast oil reserves to foreign oil companies. On Tuesday, protesters from the group Hands Off Iraqi Oil gathered in London to demonstrate outside the annual shareholders meeting of the oil giant Shell. The United Nations' top humanitarian chief is saying the refugee situation in Somalia is now worse than Darfur. John Holmes said, quote, "In terms of the numbers of people displaced and our access to them, Somalia is a worse crisis than Darfur or Chad or anywhere else this year." In December, U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops invaded Somalia to topple the Islamic Courts Union. Since then, over 400,000 people have fled their homes. Unlike in Sudan, Holmes said no emergency camps have been set up to help the refugees. Most of those who fled, including women, children, and the elderly, are camping in fields without access to food, shelter, clean water, or medicines. At the World Bank, the New York Times is reporting Paul Wolfowitz has begun negotiating the terms under which he'll resign in return for the dropping or softening of the charge that he'd engaged in misconduct. The World Bank Oversight Committee has concluded Wolfowitz broke ethics rules when he oversaw a pay raise and promotion for his companion, Shaha Alireza. There is new development in the U.S. attorney scandal. The Washington Post is reporting the Justice Department considered dismissing at least 26 prosecutors between February 2005 and December 2006. They amounted to more than a quarter of the nation's 93 U.S. attorneys. 13 of those known to have been targeted are still in their posts. Christine Todd Whitman, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency, is refusing to testify before Congress about the government's handling of air quality in New York following the 9/11 attacks. A week after the attacks, Whitman claimed air monitoring tests at Ground Zero showed the air was safe to breathe. Later, the EPA's own inspector general determined Whitman's comments were misleading. Thousands of rescue workers, firefighters, and downtown residents have since developed severe respiratory problems after being exposed to dust and toxic material. Scientists working with the Pentagon have found evidence that exposure to sarin nerve gas could have caused lasting brain damage in U.S. soldiers who fought during the Persian Gulf War. More than 100,000 U.S. troops were exposed to sarin nerve gas after the U.S. military exploded two large caches of ammunition and missiles in Iraq in March 1991, a few days after the end of the Gulf War. It's unknown how many Iraqis might have been exposed to the nerve gas. Advocates for veterans have argued for more than a decade and a half that a link exists between veterans suffering from Gulf War illnesses and the nerve gas exposure. A federal judge has ordered the New York City police to release about 600 pages of internal documents that detail the department-wide-ranging surveillance of activists ahead of the 2004 Republican National Convention. The judge ordered the first batch of documents to be made public following a lawsuit by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the New York Times. This is Donna Lieberman of the NYCLU.
What's shocking is the breadth of the surveillance activity. They were in lots of different cities across the nation and internationally. We have in here photos of people doing graffiti in Germany, in Croatia. We have reports from Berkeley, from Baltimore, from Syracuse, from Fresno. The police department was all over the country, all over the globe.
The city is still fighting to keep secret other documents related to the convention, including the raw intelligence collected by the police department. According to the New York Times, these unfiltered reports include more detailed information about the groups and individuals that were watched and, in some cases, disclose how the undercover officers conducted the surveillance. In health news, a new international study has ranked the United States healthcare system last among major rich countries, even though the U.S. spends double what the average industrialized country spends on healthcare. The study by the Commonwealth Fund found the U.S. ranked last in most areas, including access to healthcare, patient safety, timeliness of care, efficiency, and equity. 45 million Americans, or 15% of the U.S. population, have no health insurance. A group of University of California students on a hunger strike are planning to protest today outside the University of California Board of Regents meeting. The students started their hunger strike over a week ago to protest the university's close ties to the nation's nuclear weapons industry. The university recently won a contract to manage the Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore nuclear labs. And Yolanda King has died at the age of 51. She was the eldest daughter of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, Juan, you did your piece in the New York Daily News on Christine Todd Whitman. Our headlines, Christine Todd Whitman refusing to testify before Congress. That's Gerald Nadler's committee?
Yes. I reported that actually yesterday, that Nadler is holding hearings on Tuesday. He's chair of a subcommittee that in the judiciary that is looking at whether any rights were violated of American citizens by the way that the EPA handled the cleanup after 9/11. Interestingly, one of the people who will be testifying is Samuel Thernstrom, who was at the White House. He was with the Council on Environmental Quality. He's actually the person who rewrote all of the EPA press releases immediately after the attacks to downplay the public health dangers. He will be testifying. Also, the OSHA secretary at the time, John Henshaw, who said that there was no problem in the buildings for office workers to return, has indicated he will testify. He may not be able to testify on Tuesday, but he will testify before the committee. And Senator Clinton is holding hearings on June 20th, also on the federal government's response. So for the first time now, we're going to be able to get a look at what government officials did, why they decided to send so many people back into those contaminated buildings. However, Christy Whitman, the chief official, who was the one who gave the all clear, so far is refusing, and there is a possibility that the Judiciary Committee may issue a subpoena to her, setting off another standoff with the Bush administration over whether it's going to be responsive to Congress. So we'll see what happens in the next few days.
We'll certainly continue to follow that story.
But we begin today's broadcast with a look at Africa and oil. It's a little-known fact the United States today imports more oil from Africa than from Saudi Arabia. More than $50 billion in foreign investment in African oil is expected over the next 3 years by the United States. What has this oil boom meant for Africa's ordinary citizens? Our first guest spent a year reporting across the continent to find out. John Gasvinian is a journalist who has written for publications including Newsweek, The Nation, and Time Out New York. His new book is called Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. The book compares the global competition for the continent's oil resources to the 19th century scramble for colonization.
John Gasvinian has just returned from Nigeria, where oil's been the driving force behind a long-standing bloodshed. Protesters in Ogoni land have just ended their week-long occupation of a major oil pipeline hub that forced Royal Dutch Shell to cut their daily production by nearly 40%. In recent week, villagers demanding compensation and regional control over Nigerian oil have kidnapped at least 13 foreign workers, occupied a Chevron oil field, and bombed other international oil pipelines. Two major U.S. companies, Chevron and Hercules Offshore, are evacuating all their non-essential workers from the oil-rich country. John Gasvinian joins us now from Philadelphia, where he's a visiting fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Before we talk about Somalia, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and what's not often talked about is oil there, let's talk about the latest news out of Nigeria, out of the Niger Delta. What is happening there, John?
Yeah, as you say quite rightly, it's actually more of the same, to be honest. This is the situation in Nigeria is now as bad as I think anyone can remember it. Many of your listeners and viewers will be aware of the struggles of the Ogoni in the 1990s against Shell and so on. That was really child's play compared to what's been going on the last couple of years in Nigeria. And ironically, we hear less about it. But, you know, I was just there a couple of weeks ago. Just in the sort of 4 or 5 days I spent in the Delta, there were 29 foreigners taken hostage and kidnapped by militants. It's the same story, basically. It's a battle over access to oil money and for resource control. And it hasn't gone away, and it's not about to go away.
The fact that the United States gets more oil from Africa, now that's a continent versus Saudi Arabia, which is a country, and that's not often recognized by our leaders, the continent versus country issue, but that's still extremely significant. Give us the global or the picture of Africa, where the oil is and where many are hoping it will be.
Yeah, actually, the U.S., as you say, gets as much oil now from as we do from Saudi Arabia, but actually we're going to be getting about, you know, much more in the next few years. This is what's significant, is that by 2015 we're going to be getting 25% of our imported oil from Africa. And, you know, this is why I wrote the book, really, because I feel like this is something we don't pay a lot of attention to. When we think of oil, we tend to think of the Middle East or other parts, or the Venezuela or other parts of the world. But Africa is becoming increasingly important for our way of life and our energy needs. And I think it's important for people to have some idea what some of the issues are in some of these countries. To answer your question, the big kind of African oil boom at the moment, or at least in recent years, has been along the west coast of Africa in the Gulf of Guinea, what some people like to call the armpit of Africa. If you sort of picture a map of Africa, that sort of 90-degree bend in the along the ocean there. You know, it's a lot of deep water offshore discoveries that have really, been coming on stream recently. Places like Angola that are really up and coming. Angola's just joined OPEC a couple of months ago. It's the first new member of OPEC in more than 30 years, and it's an African country. And it's rapidly catching up with Nigeria. People are now talking about East Africa, though, as possibly the next big margin, the next big oil boom for Africa. That's very close. That's much closer to China, so it has some obvious benefits there. But the bottom line is that Africa, as a whole, is really deeply underexplored it's not really looked at as much as it could be. I mean, there's exploration blocks the size of France that still haven't been given away, and it's a very hot and very exciting destination for the oil industry right now.
I'd like to ask you in particular about Nigeria. Clearly, it's become an increasingly big supplier to the United States, yet we have all of these enormous problems there, the attacks on oil facilities, the rampant apparent violations during the recent elections, and very little attention in the American press to what is happening in Nigeria. Compared, for example, to all the attention that the press gives to Venezuela, where there is not this kind of, like, dislocation of the oil industry or questions about the legality of their voting process.
Yeah, no, exactly. Nigeria is the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States, which I think is something a lot of people are not aware of. We get a lot of our oil from Nigeria. You know, I don't know why we don't pay more attention to it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of international media organizations don't have someone in West Africa. They often have someone in Johannesburg and Nairobi, and that's it, really, especially in the English-speaking world. But Nigeria is extremely important. This is a country of 130 million people. One out of every six Africans is Nigerian. You know, as I say, it's one of the biggest oil producers in the world. You know, it has a large and very experienced army, and it's a real anchor for American and British foreign policy in Africa, actually.
But in Nigeria, the way when it is covered in this country, the discussion is of the vandals, the criminals that are tapping into the oil pipeline, stealing the oil. Can you describe who it is who is organizing in the Niger Delta, John?
That's a very good question. If I knew the answer to that, I'd have a lot more insight than I do. I mean, the truth is it changes often, and there are, you know, these groups splinter, and often, to be honest, a lot of criminal elements also kind of jump on the bandwagon. It really varies day to day, and it's a very difficult and very complex situation to follow. But in the last sort of year and a half, the big kind of group, the umbrella group that's been getting most of the attention, is a group called MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. They're kind of an Ijaw group. They kind of inherited the mantle of the Niger Delta People's Volunteer Force, which was also an Ijaw group from a couple of years ago. You know, like I say, things have moved on a lot since the days of the Ogoni and Mossab. To try to say who exactly is responsible for some of the vandalism or kidnapping or so on.
But, John, there are concerns. Talk about who is profiting from the drilling in the Niger Delta.
Yeah, this is the bottom. This is at the bottom of the issue. Basically, is that for more than 40 years, international oil companies have you know, pumped billions of dollars worth of oil out of Nigeria. $400 billion has gone to the pockets of the Nigerian government, and most of that money, frankly, a lot of that money has been salted away into foreign bank accounts by corrupt politicians. And then, of course, has gone away, disappeared in the form of profits to multinational oil corporations. Who has not seen the profits from oil exploration is probably the real question, which is the people of the Niger Delta. You have people living in Stone Age squalor, in mud huts, on swamps with no roads, no electricity, no running water. I've spent a lot of time in the Delta, and I've seen the way people live there. And, through their backyards, you have thousands of miles of pipelines, ultra-modern, multi-million-dollar air-conditioned, state-of-the-art facilities going up. And people just haven't seen any benefits from the oil exploration. And over time, that has turned into a fairly nasty sort of militant insurgency, as I think shouldn't surprise anyone, really.
Talking to John Gasvinian, journalist who has written for many publications. His new book is called Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. He's just returned from Nigeria. When we come back, we'll talk about U.S. multinational corporations versus China and areas, countries like Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is John Gasvinian. His book is called Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. Juan?
John, before we get on to Somalia and Sudan and some of these other countries, I'd like to ask you about some old oil producers in Africa, Algeria and Libya. They both have had oil industries. What's been the difference in their development and what's been happening in recent years as to what's going on with their oil?
Yeah, as you say, those are more long-standing oil producers. They've probably done a slightly better job of actually bringing real development, particularly Libya, to their people, thanks to oil exploration. Libya is also a very hot new destination now. It's now opening up to Western companies. I don't deal a lot with North Africa in the book, and the reason for that is, you know, North Africa is in many ways an extension of kind of Arab and Middle Eastern the political arena. What I was really trying to draw attention to in this book, which is something that I think a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to, is sub-Saharan Africa. It's just not a part of the world we think of when we think of oil. And so I've really focused, you know, kind of my book on countries like Nigeria, Angola, Chad, Sudan, you know, Gabon, and so on.
John, can you talk about how China has emerged as a major oil player in Africa and their difference in diplomacy and strategy than the United States and the U.S. multinational oil companies?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, actually. I mean, China's a big, big part of this story. They now get 30% of their oil from Africa, which is really extraordinary, and about 10% from Sudan specifically.
When you say 30%, are you talking 30% of their imports or 30% of their total oil use?
When it comes to China, there's not a really appreciable difference, to be honest, but 30% overall, actually. 29, I think, percent it is now, specifically. But the thing about China is, I think we hear a lot of this kind of yellow peril talk in the press, that they're kind of a malign force in Africa. And I think it's actually a mixed bag. It is true that China goes in and doesn't ask a lot of questions of countries like Zimbabwe or Angola or Equatorial Guinea. But there's also a sort of, if you like, less threatening side to China's presence in Africa. They, for many years, have trained thousands of Africans in Chinese universities, sent thousands of doctors to Africa, and Africans haven't forgotten that. The Chinese are very good at, you know, like they came into Angola a couple years ago and they said, look, you just had a 30-year civil war, you've got a lot of needs, you need a new airport, you need a new railway, a new highway, we'll build all that for you and we'll give you a $2 billion credit facility, no questions asked. Now, that got a lot of criticism because basically for many, many years the IMF has been in this kind of long-standing battle with the Angolans, saying to them that you have to be more transparent, you have to tell us what happened to the $4 billion of oil money that went missing in the final years of the civil war, all of which is fair enough. But at a certain point, the Angolans said, actually, the hell with you. We're getting a lot of money from oil now. We have a lot more oil than we've ever had. The price of oil is really high, and the Chinese have just given us all this money. So we're not going to open our books to you. And yes, that did get a lot of criticism, and I think it is important for people to know what happened to the missing $4 billion, and I wouldn't want to play that down. But at the same time, it's also very important for the Angolans to get a new railway, a new highway, and a new airport. And that's something that I think, you know, tends to get ignored often in this kind of very polarized debate over the influence of China in Africa.
Can you talk about Chad, Sudan, Somalia?
Sure. That part of Africa, the Sahel and the Horn of Africa, obviously a very troubled part of the continent, very poor and very desperate part of the world. Chad is a country that's recently started producing oil. It's one of the poorest and most troubled countries in the world. It's twice the size of France, and it has about 400 kilometers of paved road. You know, the national airline has one airplane. It doesn't even fly to the south of Chad where the oil is. This is a country that is one of the world's newest oil producers, but there isn't even a single gas station anywhere in Chad. People sell you know, gas along the side of the road in little glass jars from sort of little lemonade stands. All of the oil gets stuck into this ExxonMobil pipeline that was built a few years ago and sent out off to the coast in Cameroon and put on boats and brought to America or to Europe. Chad is a country that really has not seen any kind of benefit, you know, to its people from oil exploration. And yet this was supposed to be one of the great models. There was this great sort of program put together by the World Bank and Exxon. You know, 85% of the money was going to go to priority sectors like schools and hospitals and so on. It didn't really work. There was a lot of fanfare, and then for a lot of reasons, it just didn't work. But if you travel around in Chad, you see that this is a country with a lot of problems. It's very unstable. The government, the president is a guy who walks around with a lot of body doubles and who's been tenuously holding on to power for the last two or three years. It's unfortunately another tragic story of oil in Africa.
Could you talk a little bit about the impact of this kind of development on poor countries like Chad, the influx of oil workers, I think you call them oil field trash, that come in from all over parts of the world, end up working and living in these areas, and all kinds of clandestine industries arise to meet their needs?
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. You know, you start to see this again and again and again, as I did, you know, as I traveled through all these oil towns in Africa. You have often hundreds, if not thousands, of oil workers from all over the world sent on four-week shifts to work on the rigs. And they're often housed in these extraordinary compounds with kind of behind these very high razor wire walls, these kind of sprawling Southern California-style compounds with, you know, swimming pools and air-conditioned basketball courts and so on, and you know, kind of everything that you'd want, really, all the food flown in from the States or from Europe. And then just on the other side of the wall, you have people who are living without any running water, who are walking for miles just to fill up the buckets of water, people who are suffering from malaria, living on less than a dollar a day, and so on. I mean, the contrast is one of centuries, really, the gap, the gulf, if you will, in living styles. And this is a real affront, actually, in the face of the people who are sitting there, who realize, you know, there's a lot of oil in our country, there's a lot of money being made, but somehow we're not seeing any of that. And that's something that you hear a lot of anger and a lot of frustration about, and just on a very visceral level. Prostitution also is a big problem in a lot of these places. You know, obviously you have, you know, these guys, and they're all sort of men, really, who come and work on the rigs from all over the world and have a lot of money, obviously, that they bring with them. So you have girls coming from all over the place, you know, to kind of service their needs, as it were. And that obviously, you know, contributes to HIV and broken homes and all kinds of social problems as well.
John Gasvanian, the connection between oil production and arms sales and U.S. Military agreements with these countries.
Yeah, the Angolans for many years, the last years of the Civil War, were, as I say, funneling billions of dollars to buy weapons to put down, you know, to put down the rebellion that was for many years backed by the United States and apartheid era South Africa. Yeah, the U.S. military presence in Africa, the kind of U.S. military interest in Africa, sometimes gets, I think, overplayed as well. It comes down to three things. It's basically counterterrorism, the kind of global war on terror, which is largely a North African and Horn of Africa story. Largely, it's overhyped, to be honest. You know, these groups like the GSPC or the Salafists in Algeria are not really, you know, the next al-Qaeda, nor is that, you know, nor is there any kind of al-Qaeda presence in Nigeria, you know, despite what some people like to claim. That's number one. Number two is African peacekeeping, you know, the whole slogan of African solutions to African problems, trying to get the AU to step up and kind of police Africa so that the, you know, U.S. priority being not to get dragged into another military conflict like Somalia and another Black Hawk Down type situation. There's no appetite for that in the U.S. for obvious reasons. And then the third is oil and just ensuring stability. You know, making sure that there's a stable contractual environment and a stable operating environment for multinational oil companies so that as much oil as possible comes onto the market. Those are the sort of three priorities for the Pentagon and for the U.S. administration in general in Africa.
Also, I'd like to be interested in knowing why you decided to do this book and take this trek through Africa, some of your own personal experiences in preparing it.
Yeah, the thinking behind this book was pretty simple. As I say, you know, we tend not to think, you know, when we tend to think of Africa, we tend to think of tragedy and suffering and misery and not oil. And I was trying to bring a fresh approach to Africa. I was hoping that if nothing else, oil might focus the attention of Americans on Africa. Even if it's just for selfish reasons, that's fine. That's good enough. At least people start talking about it. You know, and really what I wanted to do was to try to bring the story to life. You know, I didn't want to write a book that was full of facts and figures and really boring and kind of policy wonky or academic. I wanted to kind of get under the skin of the story a bit, really, really try to bring it to life and go to each of these countries and tell stories and anecdotes and talk to people from all walks of life to try to really give a wide-ranging flavor of the challenges and the obstacles and what it means for Africa and what it means for the world that we're now getting so much more of our oil from Africa.
John, we just have 30 seconds, but do you think oil is a secret motive with U.S. relations with Sudan?
Possibly, I mean, yes and no. I mean, look, I think China's much more transparent about you know, oil in Sudan. The U.S. relationship with Sudan is a complex one, and for the last few years it's had a lot to do with cooperation on counterterrorism and intelligence gathering as well. The Sudan conflict is a lot more complicated than it tends to get presented as in the media, to be honest, especially the Darfur conflict. And oil picture kind of plays a part, but it's not the main driving factor.
John Gasvanian, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Has written the book Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. As we turn now to a crisis that is continuing to gather steam in the Middle East. Juan?
Yes, we're talking about Gaza, where at least 20 Palestinians were killed Wednesday in fierce internal fighting between the two main factions, Hamas and Fatah. As many as 44 people have died, with more than 100 wounded in 4 days of violence. The rival groups agreed to their fourth truce in as many days Wednesday in a bid to stop the fighting. The truce has appeared to take hold as President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah is due to travel to Gaza for talks with Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh. Meanwhile, Israel carried out airstrikes on Gaza, killing at least four Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert ordered a, quote, severe response after Hamas fired rockets into Israel, injuring four Israelis.
Leila El-Haddad is a Palestinian journalist and mother living in Gaza. She writes for a number of publications, including AlJazeera.net and The Guardian of London. She maintains a blog called Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. She joins us now from Gaza. Can you describe the situation right now, Leila?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, right now, it's in Gaza City, at least, it's calm. Relatively, with just sporadic gunfire. And I'm currently, I just went south to work to Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, where there are some clashes that broke out. And again, sporadic gunfire, but nothing like the past, what we've witnessed the past 2 days when I was in Gaza City and literally pulled into our living room for 2 days, unable to move. And it was particularly dangerous for people just a block down, where snipers had taken position on high-rise towers throughout the city that were populated with either residents or offices. And you had also gunmen, you know, and you could never quite tell which side it was, but patrolling the streets in a set of sort of impromptu checkpoints, stopping cars, harassing, intimidating shopkeepers, of course, which, you know, very few were open, maybe one or two. But Gaza was literally transformed into a ghost town, and civilian life was completely paralyzed yesterday.
And what are you able to tell in terms of the Israeli actions or involvement in terms of the continuing conflict between Fatah?
Between the what? Sorry.
What are you able to tell in terms of the Israeli involvement in the conflict?
Oh. Right. Of course. I mean, you know, people here are very perturbed and upset at what's happening locally and place a lot of blame on the organizations themselves or the members or the whoever's doing the shooting, but at the same time, look at it within the larger context of the continuing Israeli occupation, the continuing Israeli siege of Gaza, and of course the continuing global boycott of the Palestinian government and even now the Palestinian Unity government, and taking a step further and seeing that there's something far more sinister behind it all, particularly the U.S. agenda to see the downfall of the Unity government through arming, of course, and training Mohammed Dahlan, the Fatah strongman, and Mahmoud Abbas's security forces.
Leila Haddad, we got information yesterday about a group of reporters who were caught in a burning building, reporters from Al Jazeera and other news organizations in Gaza. Can you describe what was happening to them?
Absolutely. That building is literally a block and a half down from my own. And we were sort of in the eye of the storm. Everything was swirling around us. And so we could certainly hear that happening and then saw that live as well on Al Jazeera and other organizations. But it's a media building that houses several different media outlets, including the BBC, the local news agency Ramatan, and Al Jazeera. And snipers had taken position on that tower because it's a very, it's a high rise. And so the journalists were holed up into one of the rooms and had taken shelter there for possibly an hour or more while gunmen exchanged fire until they were finally released. And then the sort of tenuous ceasefire took hold later that night. So it was certainly something that affected everyone, journalists included. And it was quite, I mean, in my experience being here, it had never gotten that bad, ever, in terms of completely paralyzing civilian life, where everybody literally was a moving target. And, you know, many people I've spoken to here says, if, I don't know if you can hear that, but I'm in Rafah, and there's sort of sporadic gunfire in the background here, where clashes have broken out. But I was going to say, people I've spoken to have said their feeling is that their sense is if things start up again, they really don't think there's going to be a way out next time.
And what about
and that's why it's, I mean, all the more important. I mean, I constantly refer to, you know, Gaza bleeding and Gaza burning as the world is watching, just because I feel it's so purposeful. It's happening with such purpose and yet with so little protest.
And what about the basic needs of the population, water, electricity, the basic utilities? Do they continue to function while the fighting is going on?
The several Gaza City neighborhoods were plunged into darkness when electricity cables were shot down, and the electric company could not reach the generators to fix them. So there were certainly two neighborhoods that had lost electricity for 2 days and still don't have electricity today. Food and supplies, and so far as, you know, people had access to what they had in their houses, but certainly not to shops, which had closed down. Many people had stocked up on bread, for example, fearing that it was something that could continue for several days and limit their access to shops and foodstuffs. Blood was certainly on short supply, and so was X-ray film in all of the major Gaza hospitals, as reported by the World Bank.
And also, there was a report that there was a protest yesterday of some residents who were calling for an end to the fighting between the two groups. Is there any indication that...
What, sorry?
There was a report in the U.S. press here that there was a protest yesterday of some residents who were calling for an end to the fighting between the two groups. Are there any indication...
There was in the morning. There was... It wasn't so much yesterday as the day before and this morning, but very small and isolated. I mean, really, you have to understand, people were so afraid for their lives, they didn't even dare get near the window, let alone outside the house. So the day before yesterday, there was a small group of people that had gone out to protest, saying that to coincide with the 59th anniversary of Nakba, which is the day, you know, the catastrophe, the day Palestinians mark when Israel was declared on 78% of historic Palestine. They were saying our Nakba has now become two Nakbas. And now people are referring to this, infighting as their second Nakba.
And the reports that the U.S. is arming Fatah.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, there's no hidden agenda. It's not any kind of conspiracy. It's something that's been very open and reported openly in the press. But again, the media has chosen not to necessarily concentrate on this particular aspect. Over the past, I think it might have been 2 years or so, especially particularly in the period right before the elections, the U.S. began funding Mohammed Dahlan specifically, personally, in hopes to stave off a Hamas election victory. And then following the election victory, Hamas's election, continued to fund both Mohammed Dahlan and Mahmoud Abbas, the security forces, in training and arming them as well. And the sum has reached something to the effect of $84 million. And just a day ago, when the latest clashes began, in fact, Israel authorized the opening of Rafah Crossing, which is closed, the only civilian passage in and out of Gaza, and it's closed at least 50% of the time, according to the UN. Well, they authorized that to be open specifically to allow the entry of at least 450 members of the Badr Brigades, which is the elite Fatah Brigades that were trained in Jordan with U.S. funding. So, again, it's very clear and out in the open. And just about a week or two ago, the plan was elaborated on in a Jordanian newspaper before being whisked off the presses. Again, the latest plan to arm and fund and try to overthrow or see the downfall, at least, of the Unity government.
And the reports that Israel is planning to reoccupy Gaza?
Those, I mean, people here don't seem to find much veracity or in those claims. And I don't think Israel, that's something, I mean, they're actually benefiting from what's going on, and they'd rather see the situation deteriorate internally and maintain their control and their occupation remotely, you know, continuing to surround Gaza, its air, its borders, and so forth. That seems to be much, you know, in what many people here see as a more sophisticated occupation, a more strategic occupation. And I think that's, you know, what we're going to continue to see. And, you know, with the incorporation, of course, of the continued assassination policies and so forth, and random shelling of areas in northern and eastern Gaza.
Leila Haldad, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Palestinian journalist and mother living in Gaza. Her blog is Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. Also writes for AlJazeera.net. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Agustin Aguayo, an Army medic who went AWOL after being in Iraq for about a year. He was then court-martialed and imprisoned in Germany and has just come back to the United States. Stay with us.
Just another day outside of Baghdad. I was assigned to the raid. Was a 22-year-old sergeant with a wife and two kids back in the States. Everything had gone as well as it could. No one had shot at us, no one had run. I was questioning a woman in the courtyard when I heard the sound of a machine gun. I dreamed of the mountain.
Home Uninjured by Amy Martin here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Over the last several months, we've closely followed the case of Army medic Agustin Aguayo. Aguayo went AWOL last summer after being ordered to return to Iraq for a second deployment. He'd previously spent a year there where he refused to load his gun no matter how dangerous the situation. He had applied for conscientious objector status but was denied. We first spoke to Aguayo the day before he turned himself in. He was later convicted of desertion and missing movement, demoted to the lowest rank possible, and stripped of pay and military benefits. He spent more than 6 months at his base in Germany.
Well, Agustin Aguayo is now a free man. He returned to the United States last Friday, just weeks after he was released from confinement. Today, Agustin Aguayo joins us from Los Angeles, where he has been reunited with his wife, Helga, and his twin daughters. Welcome to Democracy Now! And welcome back to the United States.
Thank you very much.
Can you talk about your time in jail, but begin with your explanation of why, though you joined the military, you applied for conscientious objector status?
Yes, Amy, I came in the military in 2003, wanted to do wonderful things for myself and my country. And I soon realized that morally I couldn't participate in this armed conflict. I was there. I did the best I could. I decided before I left I wouldn't take anyone's life. While I was there, it was overwhelmingly clear to me that war is definitely something I couldn't take part of anymore based on moral principles, life experiences, so I decided not to return. I seeked all the legal channels to be recognized as a CO, and I was unsuccessful. There was a constant struggle, and at the Pentagon, the panel of three people had decided on my case. They were divided 2-1. So conscientious objection is something that they struggle with. I mean, who is one and who's not? When you show that you make the ultimate experience of your sincerity by not going back, then you are punished the most harsh way. My time in prison was a time of deep reflection. I felt completely free there, as free as I had not been in so long. I was able to share my experience with others, and that brought me a sense of joy. It was also painful since I was separated from my wife, but this was something I was willing to pay or something I was willing to do in order for me to save my sanity and not go against my conscience.
And how did your fellow soldiers react to your stance, both while you were serving in the Army and then while you were in the brig?
Well, while I was serving in the Army, those who knew me well supported me, especially when they got to know me. Initially, when people heard about me, you know, there was some resentment because we all are volunteers. And they figured, you know, people just want to get out of dangerous situations. But they, after meeting me and living with me and spending time and speaking, they could understand that that fear had nothing to do with it. And the ones that got to know me well truly respected me, I feel.
Well, it's interesting, Agustin Aguayo, it's interesting that your IO, your investigating officer, who investigated your desire to be considered a conscientious objector, recommended it, said that, and I looked at the documents, he said, you know, this is the real thing, you're the real deal here.
Yes, Amy, and the interesting thing you point out about that is that in my court-martial, all these facts came out, and when he was called, he responded and said to the attorneys, you know, no one could ever explain to me why he wasn't a conscientious objector, which is very interesting to me. I mean, there was constant debate between them. Well, should we or should we not? Should we keep him or should we not? And I think in the end, it really has to do with the numbers. Retention is hard, and you know, they don't really want to see people go, people that they've trained, people that they know they can count on. And it's sad because our country has a history of conscientious objectors and the government recognizing them. And I think it's important that we focus on this issue and, you know, consider that the Army prepares us for many things, for war, for danger. And I was there, and we can function in this environment, but we can't. But it doesn't teach us to deal with our moral conflict, because it's not in the best interest, of course.
And what were you able to tell in the time that you were there about the way that some of your fellow soldiers were dealing with their own moral issues and the situation with the war? I mean, clearly, there's not a whole lot of folks that are applying for conscientious objector status, but there is an increasing number of soldiers who are going AWOL or seeking to not be redeployed to Iraq. Could you talk about what you saw among your fellow soldiers?
Yes, I could say that unfortunately, the environment there creates a situation where your sense of right and wrong gets clouded by what's going on around you. You're in survival mode. And this results in people acting in all sorts of unethical ways. I spoke to a master sergeant while I was in prison, and I shared with him my feelings, and he said, I can understand you. I mean, the Army could potentially ask you to do some unethical things at this time. And unfortunately, many of our young people are in this situation, and they just want to survive. And like I said, that sense of right and wrong is gets clouded in that environment.
Agustin Aguayo, can you describe your imprisonment in Germany? Can you explain what you were convicted of, your sentence, and what has happened to you as an Army medic? First, where were you held?
I was held in Mannheim, Germany, at the confinement facility in Europe. And my time there was difficult at times. You know, I was treated like I had, like one of the other prisoners, humiliating at times. It's just part of being there.
Who was in prison there with you?
About 40 other Army and they were all service members.
And what were they imprisoned for?
A number of things, from adultery to drug use to assault to larcening, and a few for AWOL.
You had jumped out of your bathroom window when the soldiers brought you to your home in Germany to pack up to return to Iraq. When your wife and daughters were in the living room, you went in the back, then went AWOL. We saw you in Los Angeles the day that you were turning yourself into Fort Irwin. So after the court-martial, what are the implications of what the ruling was for you, for your life, for your family?
Yes, Amy. I now have I was found guilty of two charges, which is desertion and missing movement. And I have to carry that with me from now on. And I'm willing to do that because I stood up for what I believed. But at the same time, I feel that since the military does recognize conscientious objectors, and then I shouldn't have those charges because I just acted on my convictions. However, I have to live with that, and I won't get benefits, of course, military benefits, and applying for certain jobs is completely out of the question now, anything that has to do with working for the government. So the implications are rather great, but it's something I'm willing to live with because I saved my integrity, and I was truly free when I stood up and I finally said, I cannot participate anymore, and I'm willing to accept any consequences.
Where do you go from here now? Are you still in the military, technically, and are you going to continue to speak out against the war?
Technically, I'm still in the military because I have the right to an automatic appeal to the court-martial, and that is a long process. It could be up to 2 years. I have a rehearing in the courts in my civil suit against the Army in D.C., and I would like to be redeemed, and I would like to...
And what is your civil suit? What is your civil suit against the Army?
I'm challenging that I was wrongfully denied conscientious objector status. And so I'm still essentially in the military. However, I don't have to report to any duty station. So I'm pretty and essentially free to live my life. And from here, I would like to share with others my experience. I think it's vital, it's crucial that people understand from a different perspective what is actually taking place, what I saw, what my conclusions were, and why I couldn't return.
Agustin Aguayo, when you landed in San Francisco, first laying foot in U.S. soil again, you began immediately your speaking tour with Camila Mejia, Florida Army National Guardsman, also court-martialed and imprisoned, and Pablo Paredes, the Navy seaman who refused to deploy to get on the ship. Are you continuing to travel with them around the country?
I have returned to Los Angeles to be with my family, and maybe in the near future I will join them, and I would also, of course, go to any community and sit with any group that would like to hear my story.
Agustin Aguayo, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us, and welcome home, Army medic just released from military prison in Mannheim, Germany. This does it for the broadcast. If you'd like to get our DVD of the show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadouche, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, John Randolph, Kieran Krugmeadows, Laura Chipley, Tari Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chambly. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.